I'm Mark Maron. It's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians, Hawaiian bakers. Good morning.
Yeah.
And glass blowers, bead makers for lamps. Man, I'm getting some excellent email, and we got a care package today, Mark Riley.
I know. It's amazing.
Dude, it's ridiculous. Oh, goodies, Anisel and Tracy down there in Hawaii have sent us, like, a massive box. I mean, there are stacks of brownies, biscotti. There's Hawaiian music albums. There's Japanese snacks. This was insane, man. It was insane. And so, like, I break down and, of course, eat an entire tray of brownies. And I walk in here, and Kalo, the chubby Costco hoe, starts laying into me about my weight. Like, and you know what, I don't mean to be a boy girl or whatever the hell it is, or a metrosexual or whatever, but, you know, you're not very nice. And I know you're just working my mind, buddy. You're working my mind to get me to eat meat. And that's another thing. I get like 15 emails from people like, hey, eat meat is important. You got to eat it. And other people are like, don't do it. And now I don't even know. All I know is I'm tired of beans. All right, I'm not loving the soy. I'm starting to break down a little bit. And I get in here and Kayla's like, dude, I said, am I getting fat? And he's like, yeah, you are a little bit. But that's okay, you're getting old. And you're working me. Did you hear that? You saw it, Riley.
I saw
what he did.
But man, look, that's his job, to provoke you.
Look at the pig. That's his job, to provoke me.
That's his job. We went through all this yesterday. What's surprising about today?
He's all excited that his pizza dough worked out yesterday. You know, that's why he's got big things going on.
It's about food, man.
Now I'm just going to become a bully. It's like, you know, oh, your pizza dough worked out. That's good, Chris. Good for you. And you're going to look like the victim on the air, but people don't realize that off the air, you're a mean, insidious character.
Insidious.
That does nothing but try to undermine my self-esteem on a daily basis, just for your entertainment. I know how this works. My parents did it for 30 years. Look at Mark Spin. Why doesn't he know who he is? Oh, that's funny. Hey, look, here's some pictures. I just want to show this to the listeners. Here's some pictures of Anisel and Tracy and Hawaii and scones, which we didn't get any of. And
you're complaining?
No. She said in the email she couldn't send any real fresh stuff because it wouldn't have been fresh by the time it got here, and she was worried about the brownies. But apparently they were fresh enough for Pashman to eat half. This guy Pashman comes in, he's like, I don't like nuts in my brownies because everything in Hawaii has nuts in it, macadamia nuts, and there's plenty of macadamia nuts. I'm saying as I pinch the side of my stomach to feel the actual fat develop.
He has gotten to you.
But Pashman. So like sitting like, I don't like nuts. So he's literally all that's left in the tray of brownies are just little, you know, nuts with the brownie underneath to cut around it. Like the entire tray's gone, but there's little platformed macadamia nuts in the tray. So like, yeah, okay, dude, that's good. But look at how nice Hawaii looks. I wish I was a baker in Hawaii. And there she's got pictures of her dogs and cats. Very nice. And her iPod. She's got the iPod.
Oh, she's got a picture of the iPod?
But see, I think they listen to us on a podcast. I think they listen to us on the iPod. And, of course, that type of iPod usage is condoned by me.
Yes.
I'm all for podcasting Morning Sedition. www.ohgoodies.com is the bakery that we're dealing with here if you're in the Hawaii area. Can I say the Hawaii area?
Hawaii area.
Yeah, the Hawaii area. somewhere like that. A lot of other interesting email coming down the pike, too. But they also sent a CD of this guy Iz, whose name I can't pronounce, who's this very famous Hawaiian singer, the guy who's like 400 pounds. He died a couple years ago. It's like a mythic story about him. He did that tremendous recording of Over the Rainbow and It's a Wonderful Life mixed together, that very sort of eerie, just him and the ukulele. And apparently my buddy Jack is working on a book about the guy. He's a very fascinating guy in the history of Hawaiian music a little bit. But he just showed up in the middle of the night at his friend's recording studio and said, I got to do this.
And just record
that track out.
Yeah.
Have you heard that track?
Yeah.
It's sort of one of those weird, inspired stories. See, sometimes people have their moment. Sometimes people have their moment. I've gotten a lot of email about Hunter S. Thompson. And I know some people think I'm lingering on Hunter S. Thompson too much, and some people not so much. But it's just interesting how much contempt, you know, I'm not going to go into this in depth right now, but how the right and also, you know, people, even people on the left who don't like Hunter S. Thompson are using his death to attack the counterculture in general, and I find that very upsetting, Mark Riley. I'm not gonna tip it right now because I want to talk about it in depth.
That's
later.
Right. Bottle up your anger, and we will get into it later because it made me angry. Reading this piece that we're going to talk about made me angry.
It's interesting what makes me seethe. You know, the strange thing about the left or about liberals or about however you want to call it, progressives, I'm starting to think that those are inappropriate names because I'm starting to think that the true counterculture are these regressive, repressive, neocon Republicans. People who are really counterproductive, counteractive to cultural growth are these idiots, you know, because all they can do, anything that implies individualism or imagination or thinking, you know, outside of accepted, of what they consider to be accepted standards is somehow, you know, beneath them. It's somehow, you know, something they need to trivialize. It's somehow something that is ridiculous, you know, which essentially to me translates that freedom in its essence is threatening to these people.
Well, you know why they get traction, Mark? Because their policy is to attack, and unfortunately, many in the progressive community end up being in a position where all we can end up doing is react. They attack Hunter Thompson. They attack Chris Rock. They attack anybody that they attack Planned Parenthood. They attack AARP. They just attack, and you know, other organizations, whether it's Chris Rock or the AARP, are put in a position of having to react rather than to actually do anything. And when I say offensive, I'm not talking about offensive in the negative sense, but to go on the offensive.
Yeah, they attack.
We don't.
Yeah, attack old people. They're attacking old people because these people won't agree with them. They're attacking them. They're saying these people, and the things they're trying to connect to the AARP, you know, to slander them, is profoundly ridiculous. Profoundly ridiculous. There's an ad on the American Spectator that I saw today that was on, I think, the Daily Kos found it first, and I went and looked at it, about the real AARP agenda. And it's got a picture of gay men kissing at their wedding. What the hell does that have to do with retired people? Yeah, I know it's been pulled off the site, but it was on the site and it was out there long enough to see what they're trying to do. They're trying to demonize the elderly who don't agree with them. What shameless turds these neocon death cult operatives are.
And
shameless.
Remember, too, that there's a picture of a soldier next to the men
right.
kissing, and the soldier is X'd out. In other words, the AARP does not support soldiers. They support same-sex marriage.
This is the American Association of Retired Persons.
Yes.
What the hell is that?
And they've taken no position on same-sex marriage.
Slandering old people. These are the same people that did the Swift Boat ads, and I'm sure we haven't seen the end of them yet. And there is a series of groups. This is another thing that I found very disturbing, Riley, is that there are three groups. And if you see anything, if you're a retired person or somebody who is on this mailing list that might be getting this mail from the United Seniors Association, the Seniors Coalition, or the 60 Plus Association, this is a scam. These are Republican Party operatives that deal that this is being done through Richard Viguerie.
Yes. The direct mail conservative king.
But these are front groups set up primarily to slander people who don't agree with Bush's Social Security policy. This is the way these guys think. They put these groups into operation long before, you know, any of us knew this was coming in terms of the push, right?
Yeah.
So they set up these fake seniors groups to put out, you know, mail saying that, you know, we support this, we support that, we support this. And then, you know, they use them to say, see what these people are about. They set up groups primarily to slander elderly.
But see, what they have, Mark, is a very simple agenda. On the one hand, they know that older people are more resistant to the privatization of Social Security, but they also know that older people, as a group, are opposed to same-sex marriage. So how do they take advantage of it? They put it into that context. They say that the people who represent the elderly are in favor of same-sex marriage, and while at the same time trying to convince the elderly that they should be in favor of privatizing Social Security and not to trust the people that are in favor of same-sex marriage.
United Seniors announced in November 2001 that it was backing a plan to allow more production of domestic energy in Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
ANWR!
Its news release did not mention the organization's receipt of more than $181,000 from Anchorage-based Arctic Power, which was promoted drilling in the refuge. See, this is a front group set up by Republicans, you know, to slander the elderly. These people, you know, what's next? Are they going to, you know, find kids who are, like, going to say, my grandma's stupid. She shouldn't be able to, you know, have control of her own money. She's dumb. She doesn't even remember my name anymore. She's a stupid old lady, and they shouldn't be responsible for their money. That should be the government should have that money to gamble it on whatever they think is appropriate, because they know better than my dumb grandma.
See?
What? But that's what it's going
to
come to.
Oh, I know that's what they're trying to do. And they're also trying to change the hearts and minds of the elderly. They're trying to undercut AARP's acknowledged power among the elderly.
These are people that have lived through three wars. These are people that know the ebb and flow of politics. These are people that, if any, are, you know, some of the last people on this planet that actually understand or knew what life was like when there was hope, when there was some semblance of reason in society, when there was some idea that democracy might work out, when people actually activated themselves in social causes. These are people that saw, you know, civil rights legislation passed. These are people that saw fights won, you know, for the good, you know, and now what, they're going to be marginalized by these dumb bastards for money? It's disgusting. It's 17 past the hour. Air America Radio, good morning.
I'm the Reverend Al Sharpton, reminding you that listening to any radio show besides Morning's Edition is officially considered selling out to the man. So keep it tuned here to Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
The hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Getting all worked up. I'm all high on macadamia nut brownies from our friends.
Oh, man, come on. Don't do this.
From our friends.
Don't talk about those brownies.
In Hawaii.
Don't talk about those sweet and sour rice. What were they, rice crackers?
Those were rice crackers.
Those were wonderful.
Those were good. They didn't make those. They just bought those. They sent us such a nice care package, Tracy and Annacel, down there in Hawaii. All kinds of music and stuff, and I can't even enjoy it because Kalo the Costco ho comes in here making me feel like a pig because he wants to win $20. Is that the cost of friendship?
No, you double or nothing, dude.
You asked. You were like, hey, am I getting a fat one? Am I going to lie to you?
Yes.
Is that what you want?
Yes.
Fine. You look great. I've never seen you look better.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You, on the other hand,
you're
hot. Lose a couple. All right, you understand?
Thanks for lying.
Yeah. What just happened? All right. And you know, these people, I'm not going to, we'll talk more about the AARP Social Security thing maybe later. I'm aggravated. I'm all jacked up on sugar. I'm pissed off at a couple emails about people who, you know, who do not understand the renegade spirit. You know, I also want to talk more about what the real thing about liberalism and progressive stuff, which is what you were just talking about, is the same things that make us unique, interesting, strong, and open are the same things that are our biggest liabilities, and we can't surrender those things. I had this long discussion with my buddy Sam Lifsight about this last night, is as you were talking about progressives putting in the position to react, is because progressives, by and large, are proactive people that are accepting, they're open-minded, most of them are tolerant, at least sensitive to many different things and diversity, and that's the beautiful thing. But those are all the things that they will attack.
But you know what we got?
What?
We got one thing that does attack. MoveOn.org. I got to say,
yeah.
I will never again question their strategy.
Mm-hmm.
You know why?
Mm-hmm.
Because they got the stones to attack, just like the Republicans attack, just like all of these different conservative groups, instant, you know, senior groups with no listed membership, all of these different people, all they do is attack. Well, MoveOn attacks.
Yeah.
And MoveOn attacks so that people squeal like stuck pigs when they do. And I'm glad to see it.
I'm so pissed off at the momentum of the media to not take responsibility for anything. to allow the cultural dialogue to be completely stilted towards either the sort of pablum middle or the extreme right, to make people who might, you know, be awake and aware, you know, question their own thought processes or not engage in them by positing, you know, silly talking points or doubt in their own sort of sense of imagination or opinion. It's just driving me nuts right now. It's just driving me nuts that this guy, Stephen Schwartz, this infantile, frightened man who wouldn't know imagination if it smacked him in the face, this self-indulgent hater whose imagination is rooted in fear, who can only attack people with the true courage to go out on a limb and explore their mind and come back with some interesting, funny prose. You know, this guy attacks Hunter S. Thompson and the American Spectator, which is expected, but the way he took on the counterculture, it just makes me seethe. And then we get an email from some cat. We'll talk about this later. I get an email from some cat, you know, who's like, you know, defend Hunter S. Thompson. It's not a matter of defense. The dude was funny, and he's saying, yeah, but he's just rephrasing what a lot of other humorists did. You know, there is an evolution. He didn't cop anything. The thing is that he broke through. He was his own voice, and that makes people hate because that makes him different than other people. And most people, even people, some people on the left, just want to make sure that they're like enough people. They're like enough people to feel strong in this world. It's like the emails that say, hey, I'm just one of many who think that, or we think that, or what. Cowards. They're cowards. Cannot deal with renegade spirits.
Whatever happened to being unique? Whatever happened to cutting your own path?
That's not part of the Republican agenda, my friend. If you're going to cut
your
own path.
But it better be part of the progressive agenda.
That's for damn sure. And that's like, you know, that's one of the reasons why, thank God, whether you like him or not, you know, Howard Dean's got a damn voice. He's got some courage to say what he thinks. He seems, you know, authentic. He's got some passion. It's great. That's why people like Barbara Boxer stand out just in the realm of politics. It's like, oh, my God, someone has the courage to say something different. All these Republican asses are just, you know, all they're doing is they speak out of fear, and if anyone's going to be unique, they better be on point, on program, and, you know, and doing what they need to do for the big picture, which is narrowing people's minds, narrowing cultural possibilities, making people frightened, and making sure everybody ultimately will at least ideologically be wearing the same uniform, singing the same song, and have the same hat on.
But you know what? Part of our job is to stop that foolishness from happening.
I'm exhausted.
That's what we're here for here at AR America Radio. Because we're here to stop people from narrowing
I need more brownies.
Our options. That's okay, man. It's all right.
Give me some more brownies. I got to get back up on it again. Can we talk about Iran?
We're going to talk about Iran. We're going to talk about Iraq. We're going to talk about Bush. We're going to talk about Brussels. We're going to talk about a whole lot of stuff when we come back here on Air America Radio.
Morning's Edition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
That's right, they're the originals. 34 past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. I'm all full of macadamia nut brownie juice. Clutch Larson, are you eating a brownie in there? Oh, peppers. Dude, he's committed, man. He's committed. I'm going to be back on the points in no time. Now, okay, well, just before I do the bomb pilot that Ramon brought in wearing some sort of Islamic saber. So never, like, just like when you're waking up or going to sleep at night, don't you start, you know, pinching your fat, going, oh, look at me. Never?
No. My beautiful girlfriend rubs my tummy and, you know, gives me a little back massage. Did your wife do that?
Sure.
She did that last night?
My wife's not here.
Oh, that's right.
That's okay. So,
sad.
It is sad. So how much does your...
are hitting below the belt.
How much does your girlfriend want for her car because you can't afford to take care of her?
About $6,000.
That's too much. Can we get down to $4,800 and maybe I'll give her a couple hundred bucks just for, you know, because I know she's in tough space?
We'll see.
I'm kidding, man.
Y'all are hard. That's all I can say.
It's getting ugly. You know what? Your girlfriend is very nice, and you know the problem with my wife rubbing my tummy is as soon as she'll put my hand on my tummy, I'll go, what? What are you saying? You know what I'm saying? It's like the intimacy gets lost in my own self-consciousness. But you know what, dude? I'm going to let it all go. because I'm not going to lose this $40 bet to you. I'm not going to eat meat. I had some fish last night with Sam Lipsight, and that's the way it goes. All right, this is all going to work out. I hope everything works out with you. And I'm glad you accept that, the way you look, and that's good, man. Good
Thank
for you.
Thank you very much.
They're good for you. Have you been to the doctor?
Yes.
All right.
Anyway, it's great.
Really?
Yes.
All right. Did you get on the scale? Or?
Oh, yeah.
I'm the only one that can look bad in this exchange. You realize that, don't you, Kayla? Because you're the victim here. You know what I mean? You're the guy who, off mic.
I'm a bully. I understand.
Off mic, you say horrible things to me. I was just crying. All right. I was crying, and all Chris did was sit there and laugh at me. He made me cry, and then he laughed at me. Okay, and then we get on air, and he's like, "Oh no, I'm just a bored guy. I'm just a guy on the knobs, man. Why are you beating up on me? I'm trying to get by." Anyways, Ibrahim al-Jafari has been named the Shiite ticket's candidate for Iraqi prime minister, and we're not sure if he's part of the British administration yet. But Ramon gave us his palm pilot today. 7 a.m. Wake up. Hire American bodyguards to protect against Sunni assassins. Hire Islamic bodyguards to protect against CIA assassins. Good. Watch your back, buddy. 10:30 a.m. Take call from President Bush. Note, don't let him know I'm a scholar. Make him uncomfortable. Yeah. 11 a.m. Press conference. Promise to include other religious and ethnic groups in the new government, especially Christian oil men from Texas. Hello. Hey, what's the deal now, Kayla? No laughy at the funny? So we got a problem? All right. Maybe it's just not funny. I don't know anymore. 1 p.m. Call high-ranking Shiites in Tehran. Tell them Project Iraq is going right on schedule. 3 p.m. Reassure secular Iraqis that my strong Muslim beliefs will not diminish the status of women. It's not their fault that they are God's mistake.
Oh, wow.
Nothing? Come on, dude. Come on.
Ow. Sorry.
Enough of this crap. All right. 5 p.m. Call Ahmed Shalabi. Ask him if I need to have my whole head up Bush's ass or just my nose. Come on, big butt-kissing joke. Nothing? What do I got to do here? All right, you look great. I'm happy about your pizza, and I'm sorry your girlfriend's got to sell her car. All right? What do I got to do to make it? You want the $40 now? I'll tell you, I'll give you the $40. I won't eat meat because I don't need this. I don't need to be ostracized and crying on a break because of you. 10 p.m., bedtime. First thing. Back to the palm pilot.
Come and get him some Parmalat, quick.
Get those brownies out of here, man. There's something else in them. 10 p.m., bedtime. First thing tomorrow, check on the status of Saddam's network of spider holes. Can't be too careful. Yeah, they don't even pretend to laugh at that. You know what I'm saying, man? I'm sweating. This is crazy.
It's warm in here.
Is it? Okay, good.
Yeah,
thank God it's not me. Yeah, who's in charge of the heat in here? Oh, I get it, Caleb. What are you trying to do now? Trying to make me feel like I'm so fat that I can't sit down without sweating?
I'm freezing. I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, so you might be sick.
Long sleeves,
you're,
man.
You're probably sick. All right. Can we hear that? This is an amazing thing. In terms of Iran and Iraq and this guy Jafari, the new guy that looks like he's going to be prime minister. And let's start off, Riley, if we could, by listening to, what our, devious, insidious, blow monkey puppet of the Cheney regime's neocon death cult said in Europe yesterday, if we could.
This notion that the United States is getting ready to attack Iran is simply ridiculous. Having said that, all options are on the table.
What did you just say? He said, it's ridiculous, but we're considering it. What is that? How does he think? What does he think? We're stupid? If he's talking to European leaders, does he think, like, they're not going to understand this turn of phrase?
He thinks they're stupid.
Right, that's what I mean. It's brain-bending.
It's unbelievable, but this is how George W. Bush functions. And you're going to hear the same kind of thing coming from Condoleezza Rice, from Dick Cheney, from Donald Rumsfeld, and now from Porter Goss and from Homey. And he's not even confirmed yet.
But they're all giving conflicting messages. Porter Goss is like, Iraq is a terrorist manufacturing plant.
Yeah.
Everything's a problem. Well, that's my R word. But everything's, it's out of control, and these guys are saying it's in control. But that was a classic Bush doublespeak.
Well, that's why they brought Negroponte in.
Of course.
To be Porter Goss's boss. Because remember, Negroponte now...
The Minister of Intelligence Manufacturing.
Yes, he will be in charge and, in fact, will be the person that briefs the president daily. This is a big departure from tradition. I don't want to get too far off the ranch here.
Uh-huh.
But it is a big departure from tradition for the last half century. It has been the director of Central Intelligence who has briefed the president on a daily basis. Remember the infamous PDB?
Sure.
Well, now they're going to come from Negroponte, not from Puerto Rico.
So now, tell me something. Does that mean that we're going to see like you know, 3 years of infighting between infighting between Negroponte and Puerto Goss? Are they all on the same page with this stuff? So you know, Goss is busy sort of like pushing everybody who believes in the CIA's nonpartisanship out of the CIA. He's going to get a bunch of yes men in there, and that's just going to be another arm of that's just going to be to create intelligence that panders to the Bush agenda.
Yeah, well, Negroponte, I believe, has been appointed specifically to do that, and Porter Goss will end up taking a back seat here. But all this does have to do with everybody being on message about Iran, and of course, people in Europe where Bush is currently touring still have questions about what the devil is going to happen in Iraq, and they're not mutually exclusive here.
Right, because they might very soon be bound at the Muslim hip. So what you're basically saying, the message on Iran is that we're not going to attack unless we do.
Yeah, exactly. We're not going to unless we feel like it.
So let's talk about the slow evolution of Iraq.
Iraq. Well, all right, let's talk about Jafari. Yeah. Jafari has gone. Now, we're talking, of course, about the man who looks like he's going to be the next prime minister. He is not there yet. Okay. They've agreed on him. Chalabi, who was the only other person who was contesting within the United Iraqi Alliance, which was the winning coalition. They have Chalabi has dropped out.
He must have cut some deal. That guy doesn't drop out of anything without resurfacing somewhere in his weird oily disposition. That dude is slimy, man.
Three words: senior cabinet position. That's where he's going.
In charge of what would he be in charge of?
Finance. That's what he's up for. The amazing. The guy's got a warrant on him in Jordan for bank fraud, and they're going to put him in charge of Iraqi's finance. Yeah. He could well be Iraq's new finance minister.
Well, that means he's back in with the U.S. government, that's for sure.
Yeah, but see, there's still some trouble going on here. Alawi, the interim prime minister, is not out of this yet. He is now trying to cobble together a coalition that includes the 40 seats that his list won.
You mean Alawi, vote for me?
Yeah, that's the one. Alawi, vote for tough guy Alawi.
Yeah.
He is trying to cobble together an alliance of his party and the Kurds. The Kurds are still the X factor in this, and let me explain to you very briefly why.
Okay.
The Kurds have some very specific issues around the city of Kirkuk.
Yes.
Kirkuk is an oil-rich city. There is literally shelves of oil underneath the city.
This is like a fairly, for the most part, untapped resource.
It is an untapped resource. And the people of Kirkuk have not really benefited from all the oil that's here. But let me tell you what has been going on in Kirkuk.
Okay.
Saddam Hussein, as president of Iraq, began the Arabization of Kirkuk. Kirkuk at one time had a majority population of Turkmen and Kurds.
Mm-hmm.
What Saddam started doing was evicting the Turkmen and the Kurds and bringing in Arabs from other parts, specifically from the southern part of the country.
To consolidate that oil.
To consolidate Arab power over that oil.
Right.
Absolutely. Well, now, with this democratization that's going on, with the elections that have taken place, the Kurds say, we want those Arabs out.
Mm.
They've been doing this, Saddam has been doing it for some time now. They want the people, the Kurds in Kirkuk say, look, this is our turf. We're willing to share it with the Turkmen, even though we don't, we're not particularly friendly with them all the time.
Yes.
But the bottom line is, we want the Arabs out. There was a piece in the New York Times magazine this past Sunday that quoted a Kurdish official, one of the major political parties, saying they want to put 300,000 Arabs out of Kirkuk. You do that, you try to do that, you may plunge the entire country into civil war. And the degree to which the Kurds will cooperate with the Shiites is going to hinge on what they do about Kirkuk.
Huh. So that's interesting. So now the only way that the Kurds are going to align themselves with whoever's in charge is if there is some agreement around getting 300,000 people out of their homes for maybe the last 50 years?
Well, certainly for the last decade or so. Again, these are Arabs who were put there by Saddam.
Relocated to.
They want them out. They want. And by the way, some of them have already left. Since the fall of Saddam Hussein, some of them have already left.
That's that settlement style thinking.
Yeah.
Where you just, you say, there's your community. Good luck with that. You represent us. Take the hit.
But now, the other side of this is that Alawi has got a secret weapon in his arsenal.
Mm.
Alawi is arguing very vociferously against the de-bathification of Iraq. What does that do? That maybe starts aligning some of the Sunnis who didn't win a lot of seats in the National Assembly but are still a very important minority, the former rulers.
Well, they're also a tremendous threat to the stability of the country, so maybe that's putting out a little message to the people that are fighting the Ba'athist element of the insurgency that there might be some sort of way of negotiating, because there were some secret negotiations, I think, 2 days ago with some, you know, government operatives who secretly met with some Ba'athist factions of the insurgency. You know, maybe Alawi is trying to slowly integrate some of these ex-Ba'athists into this government.
Well, yeah, and specifically Adnan Pachachi, who was a secular Sunni.
But that guy was a renegade Ba'athist, wasn't he? He was the guy.
He was a renegade Ba'athist, but he's a Sunni, and his ascension to a cabinet-level post would send a very direct message to the Sunnis that, yes, the Shiites do not plan on trampling all over their rights. And they got to do something. They've got to do something to appease the Sunnis so that when and if they go after the insurgents, that the Sunnis will not line up four square behind the insurgents.
All right, well, let's get out of here for a minute. And are we going to talk about more of this, or are we done with this?
Well, we can keep going. We can talk about some other things. There's a lot of other things going on in the world. You know that.
Let's talk about let's talk a little bit more about this, and then I want to, you know, blow some steam off about HST. It's 6:40. No, it's not. What, Mark? It's 47 past the hour. Where are those brownies? Caleb, can I have a brownie? Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition.
Just wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Reilly.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
One past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Reilly.
Good morning.
Morning's edition on Air America Radio. For God's sake, what can you do, man? What can you do? I tell you, I don't know. I'm all brownied out. What do we got going, Chris? What do we got going, huh? That was good.
That's what we got going.
Take your time with that, kid. That was great. The timing was perfect. Man. I know. You know, it's hard to remember your job. You want a piece of me, man? Come on, Chris. Come on. Here's your liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. One, when someone calls Bush's European trip a charm offensive, say, well, you're half right. Half charming. Now. Three, Jerry Falwell's in the hospital. Send him a card saying that your secular humanist non-prayers are with him. No, Caleb's actually good at stuff. Three, only 5 days until the Oscars. Prepare outraged soundbite in response to all the offensive things Chris Rock might say. Come on. Four, criticize the Queen for not attending Charles and Camilla's wedding. If we have to suffer through it, she should too. Yes. Five, today's phrase is dropping the conversation. Oh, sure, Bush denies he's going to attack Iran. Ask him if he's got any plans to liberate Iran, okay? Ask him that. How's that Kool-Aid taste, sheeple? Huh? How does it taste? Oh, man. I'm all worked up. Chris, I'm sorry, man.
It's all good.
No, I feel bad. It's not nice to make, you know, to make fun of people with dyslexia. I apologize.
Water under the bridge, Marin.
Okay, buddy. All right.
Right. Hey,
have a good show.
Have a good show. With your mic off.
No, seriously. I'm serious. I'm kidding. What are you doing this weekend? You want to hang out, maybe?
No, that's all right. I got plans.
No, come on, man.
Thanks,
a little
but
busy,
no.
Man.
My dad's going to be in town.
Yeah, that's
I'm
nice.
Not supposed to say that.
Whoa.
No, he's not. He might come up. My dad's right here. He's hiding from something that only he can see. My wife's coming into town. Maybe we'll take that car for a test drive. What do you say?
Oh, yeah, that sounds nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unless you can get $6,000 for it from this other person. These are problems that people of America don't really need to deal with, Chris.
Well, my 99 Honda Civic is for sale for $6,000.
If you go to morningsedition.com, you'll find that there is a new merchandise, Morning's Edition merchandise, Mark Reilly.
Really?
Mugs, book bags, Kayla's car.
Yeah.
So we're done with Iraq for now?
Yeah, for now.
Okay. Well, let's move into this other thing. You seem to have gotten pretty excited in illuminating some of the tactics that are being co-opted by the neocon death cult operatives in Washington.
Washington State. We're talking about a state where Governor Christine Gregoire won by 129 votes. And this was, by the way, after a hand recount of 2.9 million ballots. Now, Dino Rossi, and I don't know how anybody, I mean, maybe I shouldn't say this, but I don't know how anybody could vote for somebody named Dino.
Yeah.
But Dino Rossi was the Republican candidate.
Maybe they have to.
Yeah, I guess they must.
Right, Chris?
He and the Republicans out there have been challenging Gregoire's election since the day after the November 2nd balloting. And at this point, they are saying, Dino Rossi's camp is saying that there have been 1,108 felons who voted in the last election.
This guy's a slimeball. You know what I mean? He just can't accept that he lost this thing. And they're going to make it more and more. They're just going to keep doing this until they have to have a revote, aren't they?
Well, they're going to keep trying to file suit. But see, here's the irritating thing about this.
Okay.
Washington state law does allow, under certain circumstances, for convicted felons to vote. The Seattle Times, in fact, did a study that said, and this is really eerie, Mark, that 129 voters that they surveyed were felons who voted illegally. Now, that is precisely the margin of Christine Gregoire's victory.
Mm-hmm.
However, no one is going to say, in their right mind, is going to say all 129 felons who voted all voted for her. But that's what the Republicans are trying to push. The idea that the only way this Democrat woman could win the governorship of Washington State is by allowing convicted criminals to vote for.
It's a ridiculous slime campaign. And you know what? I just realized I've known a couple of good Dinos.
Really?
Yeah, sure. Dean Martin, my friend Dino, who used to write for Conan. Dino, the dinosaur on the Flintstones.
That's where I was. Exactly. Dino, the dinosaur on the Flintstones.
Well, we know some good Dinos.
Okay, so he's a good Dino.
Okay.
But Trump is not a good Dino.
That's absolutely
they
right.
need to let Christine Gregoire govern. They're trying to use the same tactics that they accused the Democrats of using in 2000 to deny this woman her governorship. And it's ridiculous.
It's a great indication about how Republican operatives of the neocon death cult and the legislative pig pack deny people representation for their selfish means. This is a great example of a guy who's not willing to let go at the cost of stifling the legislative process of the state of Washington because
yes.
he's too selfish and too, you know, too pompous to just say, you know what, next time. These people will stop at nothing until they can, you know, circumvent, you know, legal election practice.
Well, the judge in the case has declined to set a trial date, which is good news because at least it allows Christine Gregoire to govern for a little while.
These people are relentless and they'll do it on any level. I'm going to read a bit from Stephen Schwartz's American Spectator piece.
Yeah.
The narrow-minded, frightened, narcissistic, self-centered, dumb Stephen Schwartz's comments on Hunter S. Thompson, William Burroughs, and Allen Ginsberg, three of my heroes, you know, like it or not, people.
Air America Radio.
What is it?
Six past the hour, morning's edition on Air America Radio. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor. Good morning to our friends in Hawaii, the Bakers. Thank you for sending us the lovely care package. My God, I'm all jacked up on Maui brownies. Tracy and NSL down there, I really thank you so much. Tremendous. Had a great, man, macadamia nut brownies, cookies, biscotti,
crackers.
And some music by a Hawaiian artist to eat it all by. Now, look, you know, I don't care what you thought of Hunter S. Thompson, but what you got to see is the way he's being handled. It's the American Standard. I don't know why I said the, what did I say?
Oh,
before?
The Weekly Standard.
The Weekly Standard. I said American Prospect, which is a left paper. And the Weekly Standard, which I never read. My buddy Sam Lipside brought this to my attention last night. Stephen Schwartz. This is how these people, these conservatives, they really feel like they're winning the war because of of the culture. They're trying to, like, what am I trying to say? Let me read exactly what this guy said, because it really got my goat. The suicide of Hunter S. Thompson, age 65, according to the New York Times, or 67, according to the Washington Post, at his home in Aspen, may definitively mark the conclusion of the chaotic, quote-unquote, baby boomer rebellion that began in the 1950s and crested in the 1960s, and which was dignified with the title of, quote-unquote, the counterculture. Now, this is Stephen Schwartz's words, all right? Because it turns out that what counterculture means now is exactly what he is doing, countering cultural growth. These repressive douchebags like Stephen Schwartz, who think it's their job in life to repress everything that represents human imagination in terms of the creative, the spirited, the dark, cynical attacks on the manufactured reality that these guys are trying to present to us as truth, you know, is a threat to them. These people are frightened, cowardly people that have lived in the shadow of creative, you know, monoliths. Creative, you know, momentum, you know, on from the 60s, the creative momentum of the 60s and the late 50s is something these guys can't even fathom existed, because it represents a type of humanity that scares the hell out of them. Here's more of his words. Quote, unquote, counter it was, in reference to counterculture, as an expression of defiance towards everything normal and reliable in society. What the hell does that mean? Who the hell wants to be normal? Of course, why wouldn't they fight back against that and try and push themselves through, try and make a little opening for individual voices? To me, this is also an attack on dissent. Culture, it was not anymore. This is his words again. Then Thompson's incoherent scribblings constituted, as they were so often indulgently described, a form of journalism. You see, people who misunderstand Thompson, and I got a regular guy who emailed us, it's not even just about Thompson. It's just a matter of, it doesn't matter what he was. It's a matter of, he was a truly revolutionary comedic voice. And then this guy goes on to lump them in. Listen to this. Whatever the actual circumstances, it is difficult to imagine a still living personage, or even one who preceded him into eternal silence and collective forgetfulness, more representative of his time. William S. Burroughs, the prose writer once hailed for allegedly reinventing the American novel, died at 83 in 1997. Allen Ginsberg, the versifier who had supposedly changed American poetry forever, expired the same year at 70. Ken Kesey, another overrated writer, joined them in 2001. The comedian Lenny Bruce and the author Jack Kerouac left the scene long, long before, in the 60s themselves. Who was left? No one but minor figures. See, now he goes on to say that these people have no legacy, you know, were worth. And basically, thank God they're gone. Now, not only did Allen Ginsberg reinvent poetry, but he was a true voice. See, this guy, Stephen Schwartz, is so saddened by his own lack of voice, by his own inability but to, you know, only speak out of fear and with a complete, you know, void of imagination. I mean, just to bring Kerouac and Burroughs together, Burroughs says the definition of naked lunch, which he attributes to Kerouac, is a frozen moment when everyone sees what is on the end of every fork. How can you beat that poetry? See that moment? The moment of truth, the dark truth, the cynical truth of what culture is really like. The reason Hunter S. Thompson is a threat to an idiot like Stephen Schwartz is that he had the courage to be cynical and see the truth through someone like Stephen Schwartz's crap. Am I right, Riley?
Well, look, here's what Stephen Schwartz is doing. And remember, too, that, you know, he's doing this because he gets paid to do this. Okay? This is how he makes his living.
Yeah, but being a whore is no excuse for speaking in a way that, you know, that is going to stifle dissent, stifle imaginative and creative freedom in this country, stifle the very progress of culture. I mean, if the only reason he's doing this is getting paid, that's giving him more credit than he deserves. I think this moron believes this crap.
Oh, he may believe it, but here's the thing that he cannot question about all the people he described here, despite the negative and disparaging things he said about them. All of these people, Burroughs, Thompson, Kerouac, Bruce, Kesey, they all had the unique ability to bring you into their reality. Now, you can question their reality.
That's what
you can doubt their reality.
Yeah.
You can say that their reality is crap if that's what you want. But Stephen Schwartz can't bring anybody into his reality because his reality doesn't amount to anything except criticizing other people's. What has he got? What else has he got? Has he managed in this writing to lead you to say, well, geez, I wonder what Stephen Schwartz's world is about. I wonder how he looks at different issues and problems that face humanity. Well, I got to tell you, I remember reading Hunter Thompson and asking those questions after reading his work, asking those questions after reading Burroughs, asking those questions after listening to people like Ken Kesey. It is not as simple as to say, and see, there are a lot of people that do this, a lot. He's not the only one.
But
they try to buttonhole the 60s
right.
into a pigeonhole that they could not possibly have lived or conceived of.
Yeah, and it's like this runs the gamut. This involves the entire culture of jazz. This involves the entire culture of dissent that, you know, was... You know,
the civil rights movement.
This is just the tip of the iceberg. This is how guys like him attack it, and he's wrong. You know, he says that it has long been argued that lasting literature is an impossibility without imitation and emulation, and that although young authors often produce works ridiculously imitative of their idols, real writers grow out of such mimesis to gain recognition for their own individual abilities. But who can imagine a youthful talent beginning with an exercise in the Gonzo style? I mean, who can imagine? It happens daily. I mean, this guy is so out of the loop, so immersed in his own ridiculous, repressive, frightened, manufactured reality that he has no barometer for for what is really happening. People imitate Hunter. People imitate, you know, Allen Ginsberg. People look up to these people all the time. They have to put Naked Lunch, Hunter S. Thompson, and Allen Ginsberg books behind the counter because, you know, people steal them.
Yeah,
you know what
do.
I mean? That these guys still, it horrifies this person that there might still be kids who are influenced by actual free thinking and renegade imagination, you know?
Well, yeah, because I guess for him, there's Shakespeare and then there's Stephen Schwartz. I mean, in a continuum, who is he talking about that is profound? Who is he talking about that is the antithesis of what these people are supposedly about? Nobody. Nobody in his entire piece. All he does is dog people like Jan Wenner, who gave, by the way, Hunter Thompson a forum in the late 1960s. All he is able to do is to speak negatively. He hasn't constructed anything independent or unique on his own here.
Hey, Stephen, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas is number 13 on Amazon.com today. All right, and the other thing is...
You idiot.
He is an idiot. And, you know, this is the whole thing is that they say, he says, doubtlessly the most pathetic aspect of the 60s phenomenon was the absolute conviction of Thompson and those who encouraged him that living in the moment, quote-unquote, living in the moment really did count more than anything else in the world, that history never existed and that the future was their property. You know, it's interesting, Stephen, that where was your NADS, you know, 10 years ago before your idiot king gave you the validation to speak like this? The truth of the matter is culture was moving in a tremendously embracing direction, you know, before people like you felt like you had the support to write things like this. You're just bitter because the liberals had dominated culture, rightfully so, for so long, and now you're having your little time in the sun, and all you can do is, you know, throw out this little self-centered rant on somebody who is eminently more talented than you, and people who had tremendous imaginations instead of just sort of weird reactionary fear. You're the counterculture, Stephen Schwartz. You're the guy that's stopping progress. You're the guy that's supporting repressive ideology. It's not counterculture in the traditional sense, but you are working against culture because you are too frightened of what is in the dark. You are too frightened of what the imagination can actually produce. You're frightened of human possibility. All you are is a frightened little man who can, you know, all you can do is rail about people that had true spirit. Done.
Done.
To hell with
finished.
It. To hell with that.
Have
guy.
A nice life, chump.
Yeah, right. Like it's going to matter to that guy. You know, the just like, I don't know.
No,
just,
you know what? Sometimes
I worry
stuff
about
like
kids.
This matters. Matters
I worry
to guys
about
like
kids.
Stephen Schwartz.
I worry about the kids. I worry about, you know, who are their outlaw heroes now? You know, who are they going to look up to? Where are the people that, Bob Dylan, paraphrasing Lao Tzu, I believe. Well, I'll bring that up in a minute. I will. We will move on more into this. Maybe not. I get worked up because these, you know, maybe they weren't your heroes, but they meant something, man. These were the real poets. Who are the real poets? What are the kids going to look up to? People like Stephen Schwartz? God, I hope not. 16 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition, on the air and online. MorningSedition.com, Air America Radio.
We'll be right back.
21 past the hour. It's Mark Maron here on the Morning Sedition with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
What do you know about that? Getting all worked up about my heroes and about Stephen Schwartz, the guy from the Weekly Standard, a conservative rag, a celebration of repression, a celebration of narrow-minded thinking. These guys are frightened of their own penises. I'm telling you, people like Stephen Schwartz wake up in the morning, and if he's got an erection, he goes, "Oh, my God, what is that? Help me. I'm afraid of my own private parts." These people are afraid of the dark, moist places, my friends. The dark, moist places are the places where everything happens. It's where life begins. It's where all answers are. These people are afraid of the dark realities of moments of individual enlightenment that break through to the truth. These guys have been fighting it for years, Riley, for years. That's what 30 years of reframing the dialogue of culture was about. We cannot let the hippie poets win. We cannot let the people that don't believe inherently in their core soul in the beauty of capitalism, we can never let them guide the language of culture again. These bastards cannot stop us from making money with their dreams of enlightenment. And then you get people that say that they've all been co-opted, the progressive has all been co-opted, that none of the dissent and picketing and any of the 60s made any mark of difference on capitalism. They've all been co-opted or as were just some sort of growth spurt in the great free market world. I don't believe that's necessarily true, my friends. I'd like to see Stephen Schwartz even muster in his most elaborate dreams of unconscious the line, like, angel-headed hipsters burning for the ancient heavenly connection to the starry dynamo in the machinery of night. Where is that now? Where is that beautiful optimism of somebody who had the courage to search in his spirit for poetic revelation? Where is the courage to search the dark nooks and crannies of the political realities of this world that Hunter S. Thompson had? Or William Burroughs, the courage to search in outer space? William Burroughs was one of the great vaudevillian satirists who had some of the tremendous, beautiful, funny riffs that, you know, that really took shots at people like Stephen Schwartz. Without control, control needs control to survive. That's all. That's all that Stephen Schwartz is. If he doesn't have control, he does nothing but crying. Burroughs knew nothing is true. Everything is permitted. Screw people like Stephen Schwartz, like George Bush, like these people. God, I wish we could get hold of the spirit again, Riley. That's why people American Taliban's name?
John Walker Lynn, yeah.
If this guy had had some you know, a little more redirection and he could have found some other outlaw heroes, we're running short on outlaw heroes, my friend.
Well, we're running short on outlaw heroes because everybody thinks they have to ask somebody else's permission to do anything. That's the problem. If you look at Thompson and Burroughs and the rest of these people, the one thing they have in common is that they didn't ask anybody's permission to explore what they explored, to do what they wanted to do.
It's just weird. When I read Kerouac, when I read Ginsberg, I was already 20 years after the fact, but I wanted to know about these guys. These guys knew about the dark places, about the beauty in the darkness, you know, and I wanted to know about that. And when I read Ginsberg and I read Kerouac, I went back to Rimbaud. They read Rimbaud, I read Rimbaud. The distortion of senses, the fragmentation of reality for poetic beauty. I mean, what happened to that sort of incentive? Are these kids just that lazy? Do they want those easy answers? They should be being taught Ginsberg. They should be being taught Kerouac. They should be being taught evolution and things like that in school. Comparative religions. You know, they should be seeing all the beauty of ways of explaining things that have come down through history. These poor kids are being denied an education that would provoke their imagination. I mean,
But you know what they're being denied?
What?
They're being denied the intellectual curiosity to find this stuff out on their own, even if they're not taught.
Well, I don't know if anyone inspired me to do that other than maybe seeing a Mad Magazine or a National Lampoon.
But there was an entry place. There was somewhere where you started and then you went.
But who's even doing this kind of stuff now? What do they have for comedies? I mean, you know that, you know, Annie Hall won the Academy Award once. Annie Hall won Best Picture. You know, this is a multi-layered, brilliant comedy about so many different things. What do we have now? What is it? The Polly movie with Jennifer Aniston? We have the Farrelly brothers who are funny, but where are the sophisticated, interesting, dark comedies that are provocative and make people want to see things differently? I mean, Sideways was good, but that was, you know, really a portrait of self-indulgent people.
They're on Turner Classic Movies. That's where they are. Oh, I mean, the bottom line is they're not doing. But see, that doesn't
Sam
mean
Lipsyte does it.
That doesn't mean that sooner or later these kids or some or the next generation of kids or some kid who's sitting up in the high school that's right next to this building, sitting up bored out of their minds, won't one day pick up one of these books and be themselves transformed by it.
I just think there so many of them are overwhelmed with a tidal wave of information, and they don't know how to find their place, and they're not being encouraged by their parents. They're not being encouraged by culture to, you know, take some chances and blow their minds.
That's our job.
All right.
That's our job.
Oh, I knew
it. If nobody else will do it, we got to do it. We have to be able to say to these young people, there is something else. There is a different way to look at the world. Come explore this. Try that. We're not going to tell you what you should like or what you shouldn't like. We just want to expose you to as much information as possible. That's what we do.
It seems to me that if you're frightened, why not create a world full of possibilities instead of a world full of repression and control? You know what I mean? I mean, that was the journey of the imagination that I always aspired to. I don't. Sometimes I hit it in my one-man show occasionally.
There you go.
Here it's all practical ranting.
Well, we got some practical dreams coming up.
Okay.
And we're going to be looking at Mark Maron's Dream Diary and some of your dreams as well when we continue here on Air America Radio.
Listening to Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
The best-selling book on Amazon.com by anybody named Stephen Schwartz is somewhere around 89,112. And if it's not the Stephen Schwartz that had the audacity and self-centeredness to attack truly visionary people, then it must be another one. Or maybe this guy just doesn't have the wherewithal to write a whole book like a real man, dumb dirtbag. 866-303-AARO, 866-303-2270. We're doing dreams, folks. It's dream time. I know some of you love this segment. I happen to like it a lot myself. We're going to take some, do some dream analysis. Riley and I do kind of a rant, you know, we're not professionals.
Not by any means.
But occasionally we'll give it a shot. Here's my dream from last night. I'm visiting a nursing home. I go into a sunny day room. There's Franklin D. Roosevelt in his wheelchair, smoking from a long cigarette holder and sipping a martini. I say, Franklin, you know, you should give that up. FDR says, Mark, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Cheers! And he drains it in one gulp. I say, what about George W. Bush? I've been afraid of him since the day he got into office. FDR says, sighs, and he says, that was the day which will live in infamy. I say, Franklin, he's trying to dismantle everything you've ever done. He's the worst thing to ever hit this country. FDR cracks a little smile. Mark, I was up against Hitler, Mussolini, and Tojo. All at that picture of martinis and grab me that picture of martinis and wheel me down. Wait a minute. I was up against Hitler, Mussolini, and Tojo all at once. Joseph Stalin was my ally. Bush is bad, but believe me, I've seen worse. Grab that pitcher of martinis and wheel me downstairs. I've got something to show you. So I grab the pitcher of martinis. Wow, it smells like pure gin. And I wheel FDR down a dark hallway to a door labeled Accounts Receivable. We go in and it's full of old people huddled around roulette wheels and blackjack tables. But instead of money, they're gambling for vouchers for food, for medicine, for clothing. Most of them are losing. FDR says, this is what we have instead of Social Security, Mark. This is under my legacy. I say, oh my God, this is horrible. I don't understand. FDR says, it's an allegory, Mark. A literary device. You've been writing down your dreams long enough to recognize symbolism, don't you? Give me a drink, will you? I'm not a camel. I poured him a martini. FDR takes a long sip and then reaches into his pocket and throws me a dime. Here, don't spend it all in one place. I look down and it's Bush's face on the dime. I woke up and my bed was filled with small change.
Ooh.
Brutal.
Mm.
Now it's your turn. Give us a call, 866-303-2270. 2270 is the number. Riley, are you ready to...
Yeah, I'm ready. Let's do it.
To do some dreams. Who do we got? Eric, listening in Beaver Dam, Wisconsin. How are you, Eric? What dream did you have? Would you like to share, my friend?
Well, my dream, my friends, a couple nights ago, I dreamed that I took my son, who's 15 and does read Hunter S. Thompson and watch Woody Allen and listen to Lenny Bruce.
Good for you.
There
you go. Good for you.
Anyway, I had a dream that I took him to see the Ramones at the U.S. Cellular Arena in Milwaukee. And we got in there. We got in the mosh pit. We were having a good time until we realized that it wasn't the Ramones, but it was one of those imposter bands like they do with the Drifters and the Temptations.
It was a cover band. It was a tribute band.
No, it wasn't a tribute band. You know how, like, with the old R&B group?
Oh, sure, they toured, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they put a bunch of guys on tour that have nothing to do with the original group.
That's interesting.
Exactly. So we're in there, in the mosh pit, and it was okay, but once we realized that it wasn't the real thing, we got kicked off, and so we went back out in the concourse and went over to, like, the food court cafeteria area, and it was filled with old people, all of whom were listening to Bill Cosby talk.
Huh.
And so we walked away, shaking our heads and disgusted at the whole thing, and there in the distance in the crowd, I saw Richard Pryor, and I started shouting out for Richard, 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 and all he did was turn around and said, screw you guys, I'm out of here.
Wow. Dude.
That doesn't sound like a dream to me.
That's a great dream, man. You're dreaming about the time when there was integrity, my friend, when there was, you know, there was. This goes right in line with what we're talking about. Bill Cosby, the safe-playing comedic personality versus Richard Pryor, by bar none, the most honest comedian in the world. And then you got the Ramones, who are not really the Ramones, just a bunch of guys pretending to be Ramones. And there you were sort of fooled by it at first. But, you know, I think there's a lot of hope in that dream, man. I think that, you know, you just you wanted to show your kid something you grew up with that turned out to not be what it used to, and then you saw someone else that you knew when you were younger, a guy who represented real integrity, walking away. This goes right in line with what we're talking about. You know, just the fear of anything with any authenticity or real courage or honesty artistically is drifting away, and you're a little concerned that your kid's not going to have it, but it sounds like you're giving it to him.
That's it.
Oh, man. Thanks
nice
for
work.
Calling. I'm getting all teary.
Right.
Thanks, Eric.
Oh, thanks,
you
all
take,
right,
take
Eric.
It easy, buddy. Wow, man. Oh.
It's an interesting dream, though. I mean, when you think about it.
But it was, like, so right in line with what we were talking about.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's just like, it's such a tremendous fear that I have one of these weird sort of theories in my head. The number is 866-303-2270 if you want to share a dream with us. I have this big fear that, you know, even with rock and roll, because, you know, if you think about it, Riley, in your lifetime, rock and roll was invented. You know
yeah.
what I mean? In your lifetime, you know, jazz, modern jazz, invented, all right? In your lifetime...
You trying to say I'm 80?
No, I'm talking about bebop. Right?
Bebop. Was a little before my time, but yeah.
The evolution of things, you know, breaking open. You know,
yeah.
Rock and roll broke open. So this was only 40 years ago. So I have this weird fear that the further we get away from that primal beginning, that explosion of imagination and creative spirit that created these things, it just gets watered down. Like, you know, the center cannot hold, the falcon has lost touch with the falconer, you know, the eighth poem, that whole thing, the second coming, that eventually everything loses sight of where it started, and there's no barometer for integrity, authenticity, or real creativity anymore, and it's frightening me.
But you know what stifles that kind of creativity? The central question in all of this, and that is, who will control the apparatus by which people find out about culture? Will it be the Stephen Schwartzes of the world, or will it be the Mark Marons of the world?
The thing is how overwhelmed and how guided are the kids today? That's the weird thing. Kids will usually find their own way, and if some of them have rebellious spirit, they will rebel, like I did. If some of them, you know, are creative enough to find their own voice, they will. But I just wonder who, you know, where are the hip teachers? I hope there's still some hip teachers. You know, I know we got a few fans who are teachers. I know one teaches in my old high school. I just hope there are enough teachers out there to say, look, you know, you don't have to think this way. Even if your parents tell you to, you don't have to think this way. I'm not going to say anything that's going to get me in trouble, but here's a book.
Well, you know there are teachers like that. I'll never forget this, Mark, as long as I live, because I went to military school for 3 years in high school. And I had a teacher in military school who I later ran into at an anti-war demonstration in Manhattan, right?
Yeah.
And he said, look, man, I had to leave the school. Now, this was 2 years after I had his class, right? And he said, I said, what are you doing? I hadn't seen the guy since I was in school. He said, well, I had to leave because the school had gotten into this whole warlike thing about Vietnam. He had heard people disparaging the assassination of Martin Luther King, which had happened early, 2 years before. Mm-hmm. And he just couldn't take being in that situation anymore. And he was a very, very straight teacher when I had him. In other words, I never thought there was anything counterculture or anything having to do. And he was at this anti-war protest, and we talked for like 20 minutes, a half hour. And it was one of those things that helped transform me, because it was the last thing on my mind that this straight, crew-cut guy would end up being 2 years later with long hair and then an anti-war protest.
It blows your mind. There's always those moments in life where the sky just opens up for you, and you're like, oh, my God, there are so many other possibilities. There's a guy being eulogized on Thursday, Gus Blaisdell, who owned a bookstore in Albuquerque, New Mexico, called the Living Batch Bookstore. And I started going in there when I was in high school, and this guy was just a monster of wit and intellect and, you know, and information, and he used to sort of, this domain was this bookstore, and he was the guy. You know, he was like the Buddha. And he died last year. Really a sad thing for me. But he was the guy that blew my mind. I mean, some things blew my mind before, but he was the dude that made me think like, oh, my God, there's a lot of things I've got to find out about, man. You know, I want to know where this guy's brain has been, and I want to look down those tunnels.
But see, bookstore owners, record store owners, the record store in Washington, I can't remember the name of it for the life of me.
And they're all going away.
I know, but there's one of those places you go there, you spend a day, you end up spending the rest of your life.
And
in
there's the
place.
One guy that's like, oh, dude, I know exactly what you're, come here. And you're like, oh,
let me
yes.
show you.
What is it? The magic gates open. All right, Jared.
Okay. It's our man.
Jared, how you doing, buddy? Thanks for all the stuff you sent us. You got a dream to share with us in Chicago there?
Yes, I do. It's my pleasure to send you guys stuff.
Yeah, I appreciate the surge, man.
Yeah, my head is still swelling from all the name times you mentioned my name as far as all the other stuff. But I'm glad you dug the Serge Gainsbourg.
Yeah.
Serge Gainsbourg. I still haven't bought the records yet.
I'll send you and the 20-page dissertation.
Oh, my
Whoa.
God.
Whoa.
I don't have time to do a lot
really,
of reading.
But...
All right, what do you got? You got a dream, Jared?
Yes, I do. Okay. I'm standing in front of my high school.
Yeah.
And apparently, even though I graduated more than 10 years ago, I missed some classes, and they just figured it out, and I'm starting to panic. And apparently, I have to go back and take these classes.
Oh,
I don't know what they are.
Oh,
they're going to take away my high school degree, and they're going to take away my college degree, and I'm going to lose my job, and I'm starting to panic.
Okay.
All right, so, and I can't take these classes for some reason in Chicago. It can't be like a GED. I have to go back to the high school that I went to, specifically in Rockland County, New York. And I start thinking through this very logical. I mean, I'm panicking because I'm thinking I'm going to lose my job. I have, you know, $2,000 on my credit card left, and I can fly back home and, you know, every day for the next 4 or 5 days. What am I going to do after that? I'm going to lose my job. I can call my work. I can say I have, there's like a 2 hour difference because school starts at 7, my work starts at 8, but Chicago's an hour.
Panic dream, panic.
All right, yes, very panicky. And I'm thinking, I can call him, I can tell I have car trouble. This is not going to work for more than 2 days.
Yeah.
All right, so I try to get into the high school and it's locked. I can't get in.
Oh.
And I somehow magically run to the room that I'm supposed to be in, and I can see the teacher in the room, and she won't let me in. I could see her. I can't read lips. You know, I can't hear what she's saying. She's saying something, but for some reason in the dream I've been granted the ability to read lips, and she starts to say, "You're going to fail."
I start to
freak out. The next thing I know, I'm like naked on a city street, naked in the fetal position, and I have my hand outstretched, like begging for change as people pass by. And I'm sort of eating. I'm not even eating. I'm sucking on a piece of government cheese like a baby bottle.
Oh,
my
God.
And I woke up, and my heart was going a million miles an hour.
Oh,
and
wow.
I was sweating profusely.
All right. Well, Jared, let me just ask you one question before we go to break, and I try to analyze this. Are you happy in Chicago?
Yeah, I love Chicago.
Okay, all right. Well,
I'll be happy when you guys get back here.
Okay, we'll try and do your dream when we come back. It's 46 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Join the morning sedition. Right now, call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning sedition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yo!
Dream analysis time. I love this time every week. I enjoy it. I enjoy people sharing this stuff. I mean, we got Jared on the phone in Chicago who had a dream that, you know, not only did he have to go back to high school because he missed a few classes. He had to take a test. There were several obstacles in the dream that weren't going to enable him to take that test. A teacher whose lips he could read that said he was going to fail. And then after all is said and done, he ends up on the streets, possibly in New York, naked, begging for money, eating government cheese. And the significant thing about this is, I think, the high school that you keep envisioning is where you actually went to high school.
Where was that, Jared? You said Rockland County?
Yeah, it was Rockland, something north, something, I forgot. It's Rock something high school north.
Clarkstown?
I can't believe I'm blanking out.
That's
here.
All right. You're on the radio.
Okay.
That happens. So, dude, I think that what's happening, and I might be wrong here, I think the idea that you have to go back to high school to redo something that, is so far in the past and such a controlled environment. High school, whether you like it or not, was pretty confined and pretty defined time. I think that it might imply that you are doubting some of your accomplishments currently, and that, that some of the stuff that you've already accomplished doesn't feel like it's enough, that maybe you feel like you're not measuring up to some of the expectations of either your parents or people in your life or your boss. I think that something recently has made you anxious and insecure in your world as it stands.
This is scaring me.
But don't worry, you lived up to
Why?
Our expectations.
Marin, because you're getting scary good at this, and there is, that feeling has definitely occurred to me where am I going?
Wow. Okay, all right, dude. All right.
A lot to digest.
That's all right, man. So, it's an optimistic thing. So you realize that your fears and your anxieties are bleeding into your subconscious. Are there any actions you can take to make yourself feel better or to make your to address the people that are making you feel insecure?
I think I'm going the right path, but maybe not. I mean, I thought I was until you guys were coming on the air. I was perfectly fine with the direction I was going. I was going to part-time grad school and doing a job that, while it's not the greatest thing in the world, my boss is a fairly good guy and it pays my bills. But
what do you feel like you might want to do?
I want to hang out with you guys. That's what I want to do.
You want to hang out with us? All right, so you do want to come back to New York. See, I knew that.
Hey, listen, if I could do a remote from my bedroom, I would gladly do that.
You're doing it now.
Yeah, there you go.
Hey, babe, don't freak out, buddy. Take care of yourself. It's good talking to you.
Thanks, sir.
Okay, man. Hey, Jim in New Jersey, you got a dream? Jim?
It's actually, I'm recovering.
Yeah, me too. What's up?
And, I had this dream that I all of a sudden I was on a plane and I was going somewhere and it landed. And where it landed, it looked like it was something like Texas, Afghanistan, or Indonesia. I don't know. And then I get in the cab and it's the middle of the night and I'm driving into the darkness. And all of a sudden the cab driver turns around and he smiles and he goes, "What do you want, short term or long term?" And I'm like, and then he pulls and it's daylight. And
yeah.
He comes to the street and there's like those motorized rickshaws driving around. And
yeah.
And he goes, "Go in there." So I go down the alley, and as I'm going down the alley, there's guys with uniforms on, army uniforms. I didn't recognize them. And they got guns and machine guns. And then they point into this doorway. I go into the doorway. It looks like a bar.
Yeah.
And there's all these women in there and everything, and there's Krispy Kreme donuts there.
Of course.
And all of a sudden, someone hands me a drink. I'm so nervous I drank it, right? And then, boom, man, I was like off. I was off. And then the next thing I know, it was just like, it was like panic hits me.
Yeah.
And with the fear, next thing I'm in the OTB in New York, right?
Yeah, oh,
I'm in the OTB, and I'm about to place a bet, and the OTB turns into the New York Stock Exchange, right?
Yeah.
And the New York Stock Exchange, right, it's going wild, everything's going, the guys with the coats are screaming, "We got Social Security money, put the bet now, and everybody's screaming and going wild, and I'm losing it, and then the next thing I know, the lights go out, I wake up on the floor in some place, I don't even know where it is, and George Bush is there. And everybody's getting high and there's music playing. And I look at him and I go, "I gotta call my sponsor." He goes, "Your sponsor?" He goes, "I should have called mine." And I go, "Who's your sponsor?" And everything gets quiet and he just zip right into what he's looking at. And he goes, "Dick C."
Oh, Dick C.
And I woke up.
Hey, Jim?
Yeah.
You got to call your sponsor.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Talk to you later.
Wow.
This is like, that's not, when you're in recovery, they have things called, using dreams. That's where, you know, a lot of people who are just getting sober, I don't know how much time he has, but if you're just getting sober, a lot of times you dream, you use, and you wake up and you're like, oh, God, you know, because it just infiltrates your subconscious, that your disease, as they say, you know, wants to drink, wants to keep using, so sometimes you party in your head. But that guy didn't just party, dude. He covered all bases, drugs, Krispy Kreme, gambling, you know, there were political
evidence. Yeah.
He's definitely on the brink. He's got to call his sponsor, that guy.
I have dreams like that about cigars every now and then. Periodically, I'll think that I'm smoking cigars again. And it's been over a year now.
I haven't had any dreams like that. I haven't been remembering some elements of my dream. Obviously, the dream diary I have every day is, you know, some of those are not exactly what I dream. But, you know, sometimes I don't.
They're not?
Oh, yeah. But speaking about, you know, I don't find myself missing drugs. You know, I really feel like I did my time with that stuff, and I don't have any real regrets about it. And, you know, it was interesting. My parents, you know, the way, you know, it's I think a lot of it has to do with that. I had pretty, you know, open-minded parents. Mm-hmm. I had parents that, you know, were concerned for me, and they were the type of parents that said, you know, if you're going to use drugs, you know, why don't you tell us about it first? You know, maybe we'll do them with you. And I'm like, no, I'm never going to do drugs. You know,
oh,
but
wow.
But I do have a story about coming home stoned when I was 14, my mother, what she did in response to that. I'll share that with the people when we come back. It's 57 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Did you?
Oh, my God, it's 6 past the hour. It's Morning's Edition here on Air America Radio. Good morning, Mark Riley.
Good morning, Mark Maron.
Good morning, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor. Good morning to the bakers in Maui who sent us all this lovely stuff today. Oh, my God. Unbelievable. Tracy and Anna Sell in Maui, thank you for the stacks of brownies, biscottis, and cookies. Unbelievable. You've induced me into a manic episode.
Uh-oh.
All right, I am in a manic episode. I can't even eat it all. So Dan Passman, the evil bastard, evil genius, son of Lewis and Linda Passman, New Jersey, I walk into the press room over here, and we've got an intern here that is a nice guy, but does not need brownies, okay? Now, Passman sets not only just the brownies, two trays of brownies, but four bags of biscotti right in front of poor Alon, who is just trying to live his life. Okay, this, you know, Alon doesn't need the brownies. That was a mean thing. And I'm not talking out of school here. Alon would admit that he doesn't need the brownies. All right? But I'm concerned now, Dan. You've showed me a whole other side of you. And you, who've been cutting around the macadamia nuts and eating entire trays of brownies, these bakers in Maui have really done something today.
Yes, they have. They've made this whole place a different place than normal.
Thank God I'm not getting high. I'll tell you that. You know what I mean? I promise a story. I'll give you a story because it's going to lead into another story. I just met our guests today, the authors of Love, Freedom, The Making of the Exonerated, Living Justice, Jessica Blank and Eric Jensen. I just met them outside. I think I've met Eric before on the train, he says. We'll get into that. I kind of remember. Sometimes, you know, when I'm sitting there on the train talking to myself, someone will come in and go, hey, you're Mark, aren't you? And I'm like, I'm in the middle of something here.
Not now.
But this is going to be exciting. They're going to talk about the writing of their play, talk about capital punishment, and just about how many people on death row shouldn't be there. It's very, you know, frightening and illuminating stuff. Also, I wanted to talk about this article. Where is that article here? Here we go. About parents mellowing over drug use. And apparently parents that, you know, drug use has gone down. Parents are not riding their kids about it. Parents are a little more willing to accept a little marijuana use if it happens. They realize that, you know, if they raise good kids, their kids, you know, unless they got the bug, like, they won't get too screwed up. You know what I mean? And that, you know, they tell them about the, you know, the repercussions of it. But, you know, what are you going to do? How are you going to stop kids from trying a little pot? I mean, the president tried it for several years.
Well, just ask Doug Weed.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, anyways, so I'm just going to let that joke stay there.
No, but wait a minute. Let's look at this dispassionately for a moment.
Yeah, tell me
who
about this.
Who funded the study?
The study was funded by...
The Partnership for a Drug-Free America.
Okay.
Okay. Who funds the Partnership for a Drug-Free America?
Okay. I don't have the answer.
The government.
Okay, the government.
That's
yes,
G-U-B-M-N-T. Government.
Yeah, I get it.
They help fund the partnership. Now, what would happen if children were not messing with marijuana or if their parents weren't mellowing over drug use? There'd be no need for a partnership for a drug-free American.
But what's interesting in this is that, you know, parents are admitting that they use drugs at some point in their life. You know, drug use in kids seems to be down, you know, and there is still a little problem with, you know, parents educating their kids about drugs. But like I said, my parents, I come out, my parents were liberal, boundaryless people who, you know, were sort of like I grew up with. I don't know how old your mom was when she had you, but my mom was like 21 years old, so I sort of grew up with my parents. And they were always the kind of parents that were sort of like, look, if you do drugs, you know, let us know, or, you know, do them with us, but, you know, we don't really do them, but we'd rather you do them here at home so we can watch you high, you know, and I, of course, I never took them up on that because I couldn't think of a worse afternoon to, you know, be high with my parents. You know, I had to do that several times and hide it, but there was the one time, which gives you also a little, you know, if you need any more, you know, sort of entries into my psyche as a listener to this show. You know, I've been talking about Burroughs and Ginsburg and about Hunter S. Thompson and Kerouac and about the right's repression of our imagination and their attacking of our heroes. You know, we've got to own who we are, you know, liberals, progressives. You know, we're all of different ilks. We all have different points of view about certain things. We all have our little pet projects and pet causes. But that's what makes us great. That's what makes us interesting. That's what makes us champions of cultural progress. And these bastards just want to revise everything out of their fear of their own genitals. Now, what I'm saying, I come home, Kalo. All right? I come home. I'm about 15 years old. I just smoked some pot in my friend John's treehouse across the street. All right? Because his brother, he always, if you didn't have a big brother, which I didn't, but you had a friend who had a big brother, you got to learn things. You got to do things early. So I think I'm 14 or 15 years old. I smoked some Oaxacan. You remember when it all had names? All right. So, do you remember when it had names, Riley?
I remember every name.
Yeah, okay. So I smoke some pot in the treehouse with John. I come home. My mom's not supposed to be home. I'm high. It's maybe the second or third time I got high. But all three of those were at John's house. All right. So I come home. I'm high. I walk in, and I'm like, and my mom's like, are you stoned? I took the opportunity to have some courage, and I said, yes, I am.
Wow.
And she looks at me and she goes, well, why don't you go into your room and play guitar? They say you play better when you're like that.
Wow.
And I'm like, no problem. You know, that's sort of the way I was brought up. You know, we had a discussion about it later, but I'm glad she gave me a couple hours to blast my guitar. You know, because, you know, you're talking to a guy here who had, I had a 6-foot picture of Jimi Hendrix over my bed when I was in high school. You know, among many other posters. But that's what I grew up with, you know. And I turned out okay. I've had my struggles, but I regret none of them, Riley. I am so happy that, you know, I have had the life I've had and had the freedom of mind to experience what I've experienced and to express to myself the way I express myself. And I hope to God that kids, you know, are still fighting for that opportunity themselves.
How old were you when you first heard Hendrix?
When I first heard Hendrix?
Yeah.
I must have been 14,
14.
15.
Okay. Right, mid-70s.
You probably saw him.
I saw him, and I was like maybe about 14 when I first heard...
I can imagine
15. When I first heard Are You Experienced.
Oh, my God.
And, I mean, I was in school, and these guys came. We were coming back from summer vacation.
Yeah.
And this guy had two albums.
Yeah.
Okay? And the first one was the Are You Experienced album. The second one was the first Cream album.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I had never heard anything like
that. Bom, 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 bom.
The first song, yeah, but the first song I remember was I Feel Free, which was the first track on the album. And I also remember hearing
Purple Haze. White Room on there, too?
No.
Okay.
White Room wasn't on the first album,
okay.
I don't think. But I do remember I Feel Free.
Oh.
And hearing that, and hearing Hendrix, and especially hearing Hey Joe.
Well, that's incredible. The best.
I know, with the walking bass. It was the first time I had ever heard a walking bass. Now, I want to correct something I said earlier.
Yeah.
Later appropriated by Larry Graham.
As a matter of
fact. Yeah, man. Sly's bass player.
Okay.
Anyway, I said earlier, Partnership for Drug-Free America was funded by the government. I was wrong.
Wow.
They are funded by corporations. They're a nonprofit organization. I don't want to dog them out. Mm-hmm. I just know that in many cases, anti-drug organizations use studies to get more money from people to fight drugs.
Okay.
I mean, that's what part of what they do. There's nothing wrong with it, I guess, if you want to, you know, if that's what you do. And, you know, I certainly would be the last person in the world to advocate, particularly that young people use drugs. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, my own experience.
I'm not advocating
with it,
that.
I am not. And neither are you. No, we're not advocating.
I did it. You know, I didn't get that screwed up when I was younger. I think that kids do it. I think there are discussions to be had around it. I think drugs can be, obviously detrimental. You know, recreational use is one thing. How many people are responsible enough to do that? I don't know. Should they legalize it? Probably not.
No, you're right. Probably not.
But you know, it's going to happen, and I can't say that it's not a good time if you don't get too crazy. And I'm speaking to adults here. If you're a kid,
stay away.
Yeah, don't.
Stay away.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're going to come back with the iNews 5000. I want to talk about assisted suicide rulings. I also want to say right now, for those of you who think that, you know, we've gotten off track and we're talking too much about the things that aren't important to you, I just want to throw this in. Bush sucks. 15 past the hour, Air America Radio.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
Oh, who's that? Is that the, you know, the, I know who it is. Is that the people that the Black Crowes try to be? Yes. The Faces. 20 after the hour. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hi.
You're listening to Morning Sedition. What a day it's been, man. Thank God for bipolarity. Today's one of the great gifts of mania. Yay! Woohoo! Unmedicated bipolar right here. All right. Anyways. I'm kidding. I'm not bipolar. I'm just excited about brownies. Got a lot of brownies stacking up. Gonna put them in the lounge. Let people. Maybe we'll send some out. We got some for. Let's give some to Franken. They, you know, every time I walk into Franken's room, that's a great thing. It's like they're almost like starving children in there. You walk in with any candy or anything, they're like, ooh. You know, it's like I brought in those Frango mints that Jared sent us. They're like, hey, are those Frangos? Bing, bing, bing. Yeah, I'm gonna bring them into. I'm going to bring them into the Franken den after this. Franken has a wing here at Air America. Some of us have an office. Franken has two offices, and there's literally, you know, at least how many people? 30 people in there? Yeah. Ah, man. I need people to help me. Right. That impression's gotten rusty. Hey, sometimes when you read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying, so I just bought a brand new iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline transmitter. Sometimes when I read this stuff, I'm like, am I really doing this? Am I really selling this? It's like we do it every day. It's like, guess what? The machine is right here. It's right here. The iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline transmitter. Let's crank it up and feed it some headlines. Are you going to come in and Brendan? I got to get Brendan. I'm going to replace these sounds with Brendan doing these sounds. But I can't even do it like him. All right, from the Indianapolis Star, Bush, invasion of Iran is, quote, simply ridiculous. Bush, invasion of Iran, quote, simply ridiculous. Translation, Bush announces Operation Simply Ridiculous, strategic nukes rain on Tehran. Sorry. From Fox News, Laura Bush thanks U.S. soldiers. Laura Bush thanks U.S. soldiers. Translation, in coded language, First Lady tells soldiers their tour of duty has been doubled. Sorry. From Reuters, Korn guitarist finds God, leaves band. There you go. Put that in the machine. Oh, yeah, I got to run that through again. That's better. Translation. Korn guitarist Steel Stash finds God kicked out of band. This is ridiculous. What's gone on here? So I want to talk about this. The Supreme Court is going to re-see, how do you say that, to hear the Bush administration's challenge to a state law in Oregon.
Yes.
That allows assisted suicide. I am a big supporter of assisted suicide, my friend. Big supporter.
You are a big supporter, yes. You are, actually have expressed admiration for Dr. Jack Kevorkian.
Jack Kevorkian is one of the great courageous thinkers of our time. I mean, it's one of the decisions that we should be entitled to have. I mean, if you are in so much pain... See, the reason why... They couch this in a moral issue, but, dude, think about the neocon death cult. Think about the conservative ideology. The reason they don't want sick people doing that is they know there's a lot of money to be made in chronic illness. They're like, that guy's on a life support system? You know how much money that is for the health industry on a day-to-day basis, funneling, you know, thousands of dollars a day. They don't want people to have the freedom to kill themselves if there is no hope in their situation because they're like, we haven't drained their bank account yet. This is a decision that individuals should be able to make in a free society.
Well, it looks as though, at least as far as the courts are concerned, this issue is framed around whether or not individual states have the right to regulate this sort of thing, or whether or not the federal government has the right to do this. Now, the Supreme Court sided with the states back in 1997. Attorney General John Ashcroft in 2001 declared that federal drug laws prohibited doctors from prescribing lethal doses. An appeals court rejected that interpretation, and the Bush administration is now appealing that decision. Now, what's interesting is this is the dreaded Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals that made this decision.
Mm-hmm.
This is the court that the Bush administration wants to split in half and actually have California represent one part of it and then have a separate circuit for states like Arizona, Utah, and other places out there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So this is one of those circuit courts that is a target of the Bush administration. And right now, Ashcroft, of course, decided to make this appeal on the last day he was in office as Attorney General. Now they've changed the name of it to Gonzalez versus, I believe it's the state of Oregon. Yep, Gonzalez versus Oregon. Alberto Gonzalez has signed on this.
Mm-hmm. So I just don't, I see, the thing I don't understand is that obviously they're arguing for the fact that this should be a state's issue. You should be able to do that. There, you know, maybe this could be kind of dark state industry. And I imagine people do go to Oregon to do this, to let themselves off the hook, as it were, from a life of prolonged pain, or if they are in a state that is chronic and not fixable, or they don't want to die in a certain way. I just feel, Riley, and this is talking about the issue, not about the what we're talking about at hand, I just feel that it should be the individual's decision, don't you? Or the decision of the family, you know, in the case of that woman in Florida who is on life support system. I mean, it's too bad. You should definitely, if you haven't, make a living will, so at least you can die with the type of dignity that you feel appropriate for you.
Oh, you're talking about Terry Schiavo.
Yes.
See, there's a whole lot of drama that's involved in that because it pits her family, her parents, against her husband. Her husband apparently, you don't want to necessarily get into all this, but he's living with a girlfriend. And he is in favor of pulling the plug on the woman, and the parents are saying that he just wants to get an inheritance. So there's a whole bunch of drama involved there. Conversely,
mm-hmm.
they seem to take great care, or they took great care in crafting this law so it only really applied, A, to very terminally ill people, and B, two doctors have to sign off on it before you can even begin the process.
Well, you know what's interesting is that this administration is against assisted suicide, against reproductive freedom, against people having the choice, but yet they're completely behind the death penalty. And in a lot of cases, even if the person isn't guilty, we're going to talk to Jessica Blank and Eric Jensen about the making of The Exonerated, their play about capital punishment after this here on Air America Radio.
Morning Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
34 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley there. Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. We'll be talking with Jessica Blank and Eric Jensen in a moment about their play, The Exonerated, and the book about making the play, Living Justice. But right now, every week, we bring you the latest news from the front lines of the four-year global war being waged by the Bush administration. Here with today's dispatch from the War on Brains is war correspondent Mort Milfington.
This week, our war president's withering volleys of incoherent flub drub pierced yet another hole in the noble breastworks of human perception, casting an obnubulated cloud of pestilence and self-imposed pig ignorance over the last remnants of that thing most of us are too stupid to understand, science. According to a recent gathering of distinguished panelists at the American Association for Advancement of Science, or ASS, the Bush administration is stifling the voice of science. To put it in terms even some of you nitinoidal blivets out there can understand, George Bush is taking that rolled-up sock he usually has stuffed in the front of his pants and is using it to gag more nerds than Jeff Gannon at a Microsoft convention. Shameful. Ignominious. It's all part of George W. Bush's master plan to ignore anything that requires serious thought. Things like global warming, this country's shrinking supply of future scientists, the lack of science research and development, and my crippling fear of intimacy. If this country's got enough money to send manned missions to explore Mars, why can't it send somebody to find my heart? There. I said it. I've been hurt. Just like those scientists. Imagine how frustrating it must be, Mark, for these knowledgeable and wise men and women of science to be ignored.
Yeah, I mean, I can only imagine. I mean, these people spend their
lives... How humiliating it must be to be treated with such contempt, like you're not even there.
It must be humiliating. I don't even think I could take that type of...
Are you here, Mark? I was talking to Mark Riley.
Oh.
Can we do anything for you?
Yeah, Maron, butt out. No one wants your opinion on this.
Well, I just thought that I might join in the discussion more because I just don't really think this bit is working today.
Well, think again, funny man. Funny pants or whatever you call yourself out there on the circuit. You can take your findings back to your comedy lab for further analysis because we're ignoring your research. Right, Mark Riley?
Yeah.
And curtain.
What the hell was that, Mort?
A short morality play, Mark. Artifice. For it won't be long before we're all ignored and marginalized, forced to live out our lives clearing brush at Crawford Ranch 2, Mars. Until then, freedom fighters, you can read, you can write, but stay out of the sciences. It's a dead-end field. That's today's dispatch from
the War on Brains.
Wow, that was a good one. I think I learned my lesson, Mort. I appreciate that, man. Yeah, it was great. And you were great in that HBO documentary, by the way. We saw the HBO documentary about Air America. That was the one about Air America?
Where I ripped the mask of fraud and deception off the face of deceit?
That was the one. And you looked great, and you made a good stand for yourself, except, you know, there was a moment where they caught you a little awkward, kind of a funny face. But it's only going to be on HBO.
HBO.
All right. Have a good day. All right.
I can't wait. Whatever.
Okay. Okay, right now.
Turn that light off, will you?
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right.
Oh, that's nice.
They are the creators of the groundbreaking play, The Exonerated, which tells the story of innocent death row survivors. Their book, Living Justice, Love, Freedom, and the Making of the Exonerated, chronicles their story behind making of The Exonerated. There you go. And it's in stores yesterday. It's also available on morningsedition.com. Jessica Blank and Eric Jensen are here. Good morning, you two.
Hi. How you
doing?
Good
morning.
We're pretty well. You know, we're having a good time. So now let's talk about some serious stuff. First of all, I didn't see the play. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I don't know a lot about it. I'd like to know about it. What was the play itself, The Exonerated, and how'd that come about?
Well, it's sort of what was it and what is it? Or it's actually been quite a bit more ongoing than we anticipated originally.
Okay.
They just did a Court TV movie of it
with Susan Sarandon.
Yeah,
I saw it advertised. But
yeah,
I can't say, and all these
heavy hitters. I mean,
they did a great job. Bob Balaban directed it.
Nobody was more surprised than us than it
okay.
was that it's been this successful. We intended to do it in the theater for 90 of our friends. But I guess Jessica can tell you a little bit about how we started with the idea.
Yeah, well, absolutely. In 2000, was it? February 2000, we were at a conference on the death penalty at Columbia. And we were learning about a group of cases called the Death Row 10. These
are
cases.
It was actually an early date where you kind of say yes to everything. You know?
Yeah. I was like, let's go to a death penalty conference.
Okay.
And Eric's like,
that,
okay.
That would have sucked me right in. It was like, hey, this sounds interesting.
We've been going out for about a month. So he was very agreeable at that point. So.
Either she's really smart or crazy.
So we were at a workshop on these cases called the Death Row 10, which are a group of guys in Chicago who all had their confessions apparently tortured out of them by a particular police commander who was found through an internal investigation to have done that and fired. But these guys, some of whom had no other evidence against them besides these quote-unquote confessions, were still sitting in prison. So we heard a lecture about the cases and saw some documentary footage, and it was all very disturbing but also kind of intellectual.
Mm-hmm.
And then the organizers had set up a phone call from one of the guys in prison and hooked the phone up to a speaker, so for a few minutes he was actually talking to us in the room. By the end of the call, we were crying. Everyone in the room was crying. It only lasted 3 minutes. But then after the call was cut off, Eric kind of looked around, and he was like, you know what? Everybody who's here is at a death penalty conference. Like,
right,
these
right.
are the people that need to be having
these
this experience.
These are converted, you know.
Right. So how we started writing notes back and forth to each other about how do you get around that problem. And
I think I'm in love with you.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. And will you please go out with me again?
Totally. And, and we're both actors, so we immediately thought of theater. You know, how do you bring this kind of emotional, immediate human experience to people who wouldn't think they'd be interested
and
in the subject?
I was friends with a guy named Moises Kaufman who wrote The Laramie Project. And,
okay.
And, you know, documentary theater is sort of a new form that's kind of been percolating for a while. I mean, it's not. Did I say percolating?
Yeah,
I
did it they did say percolating.
You know, it's nuclear. It's existed since the 60s and 70s, and actually even earlier in the 30s with living newspapers that people did. But in terms of an actual commercial form that people will go see, it's sort of new. Anna DeVere Smith, people like that have been doing it. So.
Sure. So you decided this was the form it was going to take.
Yeah, and we
you
actually got the idea in that conversation to talk to people who had been sent to death row for crimes they didn't commit and freed amidst overwhelming evidence of their innocence. And so we got to work. We started doing a ton of research, and that summer we went on the road. We talked to about 40 exonerated death row inmates on the phone, and then we traveled to talk to about 20 of them in person. And that, you know, that's a lot of what we talk about in the book is that first journey and all of the research we did and the interviews we did.
That later became the play.
That later became the play.
No, the late Ossie Davis was in the play.
He was. He was in a reading at the United Nations.
Wow.
One of my heroes. Yeah.
He was beautiful. It was amazing.
One of the things that I have always found interesting about the death penalty in America is the extent to which, when you talk to prosecutors, they see it as this underpinning of the judicial system, and that as people are exonerated from death row, they seem to feel as if somehow undercuts the system. Did you encounter that?
Absolutely.
Oh, man. You know, it actually sort of, the play accidentally, I don't know what I'm trying to say. I'm a little nervous.
That's all right. Relax.
It's okay. You're percolating.
Eric
loves something.
Air America.
Oh, it's okay.
But, yeah, no, it's really interesting to see that, actually, to see. Especially the more high profile it gets, we saw this a lot with the movie that was on Court TV, because then you're really sort of, it's no longer just a sort of liberal New York off-Broadway theater kind of thing. It's like going into people's living rooms. And it's interesting to see the response from prosecutors in the media. Obviously not all prosecutors. We've actually had a lot of support from a lot of really wonderful prosecutors. But some folks feel very, very threatened by this idea that the system makes mistakes. And I think, you know, it's sort of natural. A lot of people really want to trust authority because it makes them feel safe.
Well, they just voted this monkey back into office.
That's
barely.
Right. I mean, exactly. And I think it's based on exactly the same thing.
And I mean, that's kind of where I was coming from, too. I mean, I'm a progressive from Minnesota, but my great-grandfather was a county judge and my grandfather was a highway patrolman. And I was raised to have a lot of faith in the system, but also to have faith in the system because the people who I knew who were in the system were essentially good people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the vast majority of people who are involved in the system are in their own personal lives good people. But the system itself is so corrupt. The systemic problems are so vast, so large.
Plenty of them are corrupt as well, though.
Well, I don't want to cast this. I'm from the Midwest.
Okay.
So.
Yeah, but you're living here in New York. Yeah, right. That was the program. You know, when you talk about the exonerated, and I hate to do this, but when you talk about the exonerated, you also have to wonder how many people throughout the history of the death penalty in this country were executed who were actually innocent.
That's right.
And that's a scary process.
That's right, because I think, you know, what we found that was really interesting as we started talking to people who had been exonerated was that each one of them had been freed because something special happened to them. A documentarian got interested in their case, a group of law students, a crusading pro bono attorney who worked for free for 20 years, Barry Shack, absolutely, Larry Marshall at Northwestern, guys like that.
And Jesus came back.
Yeah, right. But it was never through the normal workings of the system. And some people say, oh, well, they were exonerated. That means the system works. It corrects its own mistakes. Well, actually, none of these people were freed because of the normal way the system works, that it always took them writing hundreds of letters and somebody got interested.
Let's talk about some of that. Let's take a break and talk about some of those specific cases about people who are exonerated. I can't even imagine the feeling of elation and anger at the same time. Yeah. That, you know, I've only felt that a little the day I was married, but it's on a much smaller scale. And Eric, I want you to regroup your thoughts. I don't want you leaving here today saying, damn, I should have just... All right, so we're going to take a few minutes.
I love you.
I love you too. But I just want to make sure you walk away happy. We're going to finish the conversation about the Living Justice, the book Love, Freedom, and the Making of the Exonerated. We have Jessica Blank, Eric Jensen here. The book is at morningsedition.com. It's 45 past the hour.
You're listening to Morning Sedition, the highest rated, most respected news show in America. On Air America Radio.
Hi.
Fifty past the hour, we're going to take this thing in for landing here. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hey.
Our guests in the studio are Jessica Blank, Eric Jensen.
I had one of the brownies. I feel much better.
Eric's back on track.
Yeah.
He had one of the Hawaiian brownies that were sent to us, the macadamia cream cheese brownies. The play that they put together and wrote, The Exonerated, the book, is about the creation of this, what'd you call it, what type of theater is it? Journalistic theater. Documentary theater.
It's our own faith-based initiative.
Living Justice is the book. It's available at a discount at morningsedition.com. So let's talk about these exonerated prisoners and how that happens. Because, you know, as you said, Jessica, that some people think that the system corrects itself, but not without a tremendous amount of support and work and somebody to take up the case.
Well, let me talk about one particular case that appeared in the play, and we talk a little bit about it in the book. You know, any of these stories could be their own books in and of themselves, so we briefly excerpt each of the cases. There's a guy named Gary Gauger in Illinois, where I actually believe your producer, Dan? Is it
Dan Passman, son of Lewis and Linda Passman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just got here from Chicago shortly, not too long ago. Anyway, Gary Gauger's parents were murdered. Gary had some late night bouts of his own where he, you know, sort of go out. And he came home one night and fell asleep, and the next morning he got up and his parents weren't around. And then his parents weren't around for like 24 hours or something. And initially he was not too concerned about it because, you know, they're Midwesterners and they sort of go off and do their own thing. You don't need to inform them.
They disappear for days.
And they'd been talking about going away for the weekend.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
So he got up the next morning on the farm. They still weren't there. He was getting ready to call the police. Somebody came up the driveway because his parents had a motorcycle shop. And he took him to the back room where they thought the part for this guy's motorcycle might be. And he found his father's body. Shortly after, he thought initially that his father had a heart attack, and then he calls the police, and they say, no, you know, his throat's been slashed. We suspect foul play. They looked around the property a little more, and they found his mother's body in a trailer. Immediately, because Gary's a hippie, basically, they started questioning Gary.
Well, and because I think this is important to point out, too, because he was in shock. And the cops, I think, actually later said that they didn't think that his emotional reaction was the reaction that somebody should have upon finding their parent's body, and they immediately decided that he was a suspect.
Right. Mm. So, very, very quickly, in short order, well, it wasn't actually very quickly, they interrogated him for like 10 hours. Without arresting him. And very, very soon after that, he was sentenced to death. And it took his sister, it took Larry Marshall at the Center on Wrongful Convictions in Illinois at a Northwestern university, and a lot of people to finally get Gary out of prison. And the reason he gets out is because the FBI and the ATF were running wiretaps on a gang of people, a Hells Angels type gang called the Outlaws. And they actually got two people on tape. Confessing to the murder.
Accidentally.
But even though they had that evidence, the whole rest of the time, the state was still trying to say, well, you know, Gary must have been involved somehow, even after they realized
they didn't want to admit
the
mistake screw
up that they engaged in. Hmm. Now, finally, Gary got a pardon from the governor of Illinois recently, and at least legally, it's been wiped from his record. But emotionally, the toll it's had on him, the fact that he wasn't even allowed to mourn his parents.
Was that George Ryan? Was it Governor Ryan?
It was Governor
that pardoned
Ryan.
Him? Yeah. Ryan pardoned a group of prisoners that were on death row in Illinois.
Right.
He was the guy that had the cathartic seizure of conscience.
Yes.
Right, exactly.
He commuted the sentences of everyone on death row, and then I think he issued like four or five full pardons also. And he actually, it was amazing, he saw the play while he was in the process of
making
the decision.
Yeah.
It was a really extraordinary thing.
We were part of the
thing.
Conversation.
So what, now how many, now I read an extraordinary number of what, the percentage of people on death row that are assumed to be innocent. Is 68%?
Wow.
Is that true?
I don't know. I've never heard that statistic, but you know what? Given the fact that all of the people we know who were exonerated had something very special happen to them, one can extrapolate from that that there are a lot of people out there who aren't so lucky who might be just as innocent.
You know,
now I'm wondering
where I got the number.
Well, there's also a lot of bad people on death row, too. I mean, there were a couple of people that we talked to who said who had been on death row themselves for crimes they hadn't committed who said, listen, there's some bad dudes there. They should be in jail, definitely.
How much of this is about class and race and people not being able to afford
it?
All of it.
Okay.
There's you would be hard pressed to find a middle class or wealthy person on death row, and there's a disproportionate number of black people on death row.
That's right. We met people from all different walks of life, all over the country, different races, different educational backgrounds, different criminal histories, all of that. And the one thing all of them had in common was that none of them had the resources to hire a lawyer who could match the resources the
prosecution. To find a loophole to at least get their sentence.
Or just to have equal representation to the prosecution.
Sure. And in the context, also, there's this one thing that I want to mention about Living Justice, about her book, before we go. In the context of the book, actually what we expected was the same thing we talked about at the beginning of the program, that these stories were very dark and that our journey would be very dark. But actually what we found is some of the brightest lights in America. The book itself is not only just about the death penalty, it's about Jessica and I's relationship starting and us eventually getting married and things like that. So
congratulations.
It's a very hopeful thing, and I think that the Democrats could definitely learn something from the way that we talk about faith in the book, too.
Do you hear that, Democrats? The book is Living Justice, Love, Freedom, and the Making of the Exonerated. Jessica Blank, Eric Jensen, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. It was
actually very sweet.
Yeah, it was. It was fun.
And,
don't be strangers.
Okay.
Well, there's the fax machine. It's time for the liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. So write these down here, your marching orders for today. One, when someone calls Bush's European trip a charm offensive, say, well, you're half right. Two, Jerry Falwell's in the hospital. Send him a card saying that your secular humanist non-prayers are with him. Three, only 5 days until the Oscars. Prepare outrage soundbite in response to all the offensive things Chris Rock might say. Four, criticize the Queen for not attending Charles and Camilla's wedding. If we have to suffer through it, she should too. Five, today's phrase, just drop it into conversation. Oh, sure, Bush denies he's going to attack Iran. Ask him if he's got any plans to liberate Iran. Okay, ask him that. How's that Kool-Aid taste, sheeple? What's going on tomorrow there, Riley?
Tomorrow we've got authors Anne-Marie Oliver and Paul Steinberg. We'll be here to discuss their book, The Road to Martyr Square, A Journey into the World of the Super. suicide bomber, Mark Maron.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's going to be deep.
That's going to be heavy.
Yeah.
This is going to be a little heavier than even what you were. You know, boy, we should have you on the same show again.
Yeah, right?
People could have been crying in their cereal.
Thanks again for being with us. We're back tomorrow. Have a good one, Maron.
You too, Riley.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.